Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and this morning's conversation is with Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Thad Allen. Also joining us in our conversation is Dave Abel, Director of IBM's Homeland Security Services. Admiral, can you describe to us some of your key organizational priorities for fiscal year 07?
I can. One of them is maintaining our legacy fleet while we build out the new deepwater fleet and making sure that it's supported. We have used our assets up faster since 9/11 than we'd anticipated, and the gap between our old equipment and the arrival of new equipment is creating some problems, especially in air patrol hours and patrol boat hours for us down south. So I guess the number one priority would be to make sure we maintain our current fleet so we can execute our mission. A second priority is to establish our new mission of air intercept for the National Capital Region, which we started last week. Fiscal year 07 carries resources for us to do that. And we'll be operating out of Reagan Airport, and we'll be intercepting general aviation aircraft that happen to stray into the National Capital Area. Continuing the Deepwater Project is important for us, too, to make sure we keep our capitalization on track. We've had great support from the administration and the Congress in that regard. And finally is to make sure that we are sustaining our homeland security missions. There are also extra resources in the budget for us to increase our inspection of waterfront facilities and overseas ports.
Could you describe the Coast Guard's principles of operation as outlined in the publication America's Maritime Guardian? How do these principles empower and enable the execution of your critical missions?
Well, a few years ago, we decided to boil down the essence of the Coast Guard or quite frankly, sketch out our organizational DNA in a doctrinal publication we call Pub 1, and it's very similar to what they do in the DOD side of the house. There is a joint staff Pub 1 that lays out, this is what we expect, these are the principles by which we operate under. In the Coast Guard Pub 1, we have laid out principles of operation, and they include things like the principle of restraint. Since we are a law enforcement organization, when we're not operating with DOD, we need to understand that the Constitution applies and we're dealing with our fellow citizens, and so we need to treat them with respect. In fact, Alexander Hamilton wrote a great treatise admonishing his revenue cutter captains to make sure that they understood that they were dealing with fellow citizens and doing boardings. Another one would be the principle of on-scene initiative that I mentioned earlier. That's the notion that if you're on scene, you have the resources and you have the capability and you're empowered to do that. We expect you to act and do what you're supposed to do out there. And that was shown no better than in the skies over New Orleans.
Speaking of the skies over New Orleans, the Coast Guard received much praise in most post-Katrina assessments, rescuing over 33,000 lives. Is there something unique about the organization of the Coast Guard that allowed such an exceptional response to a complicated circumstance like Katrina?
I think most folks in the Coast Guard would tell you that we were just carrying out our normal mission under our normal doctrine, but we just encountered an anomalous asymmetrical event that completely was off the scope in terms of scale. But we were able to get enough aircraft into the area to have a meaningful impact. We didn't rescue everybody down there. There were some wonderful people from Fish and Wildlife in the state of Louisiana and other folks that really contributed. But as a result of our air forces, our small boat forces, and the evacuations of the nursing homes by our people there, we were able to save between 33,000 and 34,000 people. The reason that was possible is that we have multi-missioned aircraft, we have multi-missioned people. We basically took every existing aircraft that wasn't being flown for search and rescue in the Coast Guard and brought it down to the New Orleans area in excess of 40 aircraft. In fact, to the point where we asked the Canadians to come down and assume the search and rescue guard in New England so we could take the helicopters and move them down there. Once we did that, because we train our people as multi-mission, we were able to intermix pilots, crews, and maintenance crews from all over the Coast Guards. One day I was flying on a H-60 helicopter from Cape Cod with a pilot from San Diego, a co-pilot from Michigan, and a rescue swimmer from Mobile, Alabama, all in the same airframe, working seamlessly because they operate under the same doctrine. There's repeatable training and tactics that they use, and you can go to any aircraft, put the crew together, and they can fly.
One of the things that was very complicated in the overall response to Katrina was the necessity for communication and interoperability between federal, state, and local organizations. How has the Coast Guard's relationship with different levels of organizations changed or strengthened since the response to Katrina?
Well, I think it has changed, and I think it has strengthened. This is not a Coast Guard issue. This is an overall federal issue, and there are two components to this. I testified recently on the Hill, and I tried to break this down into an organizational component and a technology component. The organizational component is interoperability at all levels of government, and then horizontally, and that's the ability to get into the same command center, share the same spaces, understand the doctrine, understand what you're trying to accomplish, and be able to work seamlessly across all the federal agencies and then down through the state and local governments. That's the organizational component of command and control. There's a technical component to that, and that's interoperability of communications, and that's who's got what radios, what frequency they operate on, and who can talk to who. That was probably the bigger problem in New Orleans than anything else. Number one, they lost the communications infrastructure in and around the city. And when they were trying to bring that back up, to have all the different first responders down there sometimes operating on different radio spectrum was a problem. And it was identified as a problem. It's being worked right now as a result of the lessons learned reports that came out of Katrina. In relation to the Coast Guard, we operate under maritime mobile radio frequencies. And we have a coastal radio system that's set up to get the Mayday calls when they come in. We were able to reestablish our system, but our system ultimately needs to be able to talk with the land first responders, which are in a different frequency spectrum. We're in the process right now of changing out our Coast Guard radio system under a project called Rescue 21 that allows us to be more interoperable with state and local responders. And I would say that is an enduring challenge for the entire United States. And when state and localities are buying radio systems, they need to really think about the interoperability with the federal first responders.
You've referred to the flooding of New Orleans as a weapon of mass effect unleashed on a city without criminality. It's an interesting view. Can you elaborate a little bit on that assessment?
I can. The reason I use that term is it invokes a different paradigm than normal hurricane response. And I think one of the failures in the Katrina response was a failure to understand that we weren't operating in a traditional mode against a traditional hurricane as far as mounting a response, that something else had happened that made it more complex, that made it asymmetrical and made it anomalous, and that was the breaching of the levees. If the levees had not breached in New Orleans, you would have found what I would call ground zero of the event to be Waveland and Bay St. Louis, Mississippi, which were almost wiped off the face of the earth by a 25 to 30-foot tidal surge. But with the flooding of New Orleans, you had a different degree of a problem set. And what you're really dealing with was the equivalent of a weapon of mass effect being used on the city without criminality. And the reason I say that's significant is if there had been criminality involved, we would have known what to do. There would have been a senior law enforcement officer in charge. We would have been trying to fight the thing as a crime scene. We have been trying to deal with the implications associated with the criminality involved in that. But since there was none, there wasn't a cue for anybody to understand that it was something different. And in the absence of understanding that there was something different and anomalous about it, we treated it as a regular run-of-the-mill hurricane, which was not the right response.
So you mentioned some of the things that we can do going forward technically to be able to prepare ourselves for similar responses. Are there things that we need to do organizationally or operationally to be able to do that as well?
There are, and we're already working on those. For instance, FEMA is the federal coordinator for what we call mission assignments. If there's something that needs to be done, FEMA is not expected to provide that particular service. They're expected to go find it and provide it to the state and local governments. They do that through what's called a mission assignment. And they can issue a mission assignment to the Coast Guard, to the Corps of Engineers, and that's how they handle things like debris removal with the Corps of Engineers. Between FEMA and the Coast Guard over the last year since Katrina, we have come up with pre-scripted mission assignments. So we come up with a scenario on which you'd need, let's say, Coast Guard airlift or Coast Guard surveillance of a coastline. We write it out, with the exception of filling in the date and the time. We both hold the piece of paper. When the event occurs and they need to move us, it's a matter of filling in the blank, signing the paper, and we're gone. And we can actually launch on verbal notification, which is what we would. It's this pre-negotiation of mission assignments. Plus, we have trained Coast Guard admirals to be principal federal officials, similar to the duties I performed, and have jointly trained them with the FEMA's federal coordinating officers. And we have deployed as teams. We have evaluated evacuation plans, and we have tested the deployability of these folks. And that's way far ahead of where we've ever been before.
Admiral, with the very broad mission that the U.S. Coast Guard has, collaboration must be critical to your operations. How is the Coast Guard enhancing coordination and collaboration amongst all the other components of the Department of Homeland Security?
Well, I think the first big example is something I've been involved in for the first 3 years of the department till I went down to Katrina last year, and that's the Joint Requirements Council. That's an entity that takes a look at all the requirements of the department, and as major acquisitions are being looked at the department, they review them to see whether or not there are commonality requirements so you're not buying two platforms when you can buy one. And this relates to everything from aircraft clear down to when they're one of the most successful projects that they ran was a consolidated handgun buy for the entire department, where whether you were Secret Service, Coast Guard, or Customs and Border Protection, we were buying off the same handgun contract with a tremendous cost savings. They've done also the same thing for IT licenses, software licenses, and things like that. And I don't think there's probably any end to the particular partnerships that we can form that will achieve better efficiency and effectiveness inside the department. But the Joint Requirements Council would be one example of that.
Along the same lines of collaboration, how does the Coast Guard plan to better integrate operations and assets with the Department of Defense, specifically the U.S. Navy, and how does the National Fleet Policy assist in facilitating this integration?
Well, you know, we have a great relationship with the Navy. It's never been better, and we have an enduring requirement to be interoperable with them in time of war or when we're needed for a combatant commander. Admiral Mike Mullen and I have a great relationship, and we believe if you take the Navy's fleet and the Coast Guard's fleet and you put them together, you have a national fleet. We have the world's best Navy and we have the world's best Coast Guard. Together, they make the world's best maritime force. So he and I are working very, very hard to operationalize this concept. And a good example of that would be the Littoral Combat Ship, which was just launched a couple weeks ago, has a deck gun, 57-millimeter deck gun. It's the same deck gun that we will use on our large cutters. And wherever we can, we're looking at where we have commonality of requirements to have commonality of systems or platforms, and that would be a good example of that. And that's needed because you talked about interoperability with DOD. We have negotiated as part of the National Strategy for Maritime Security protocols under which the Navy and the Coast Guard and other forces will work together on whether or not it's a homeland security or a law enforcement issue, if you will, or whether it's a Department of Defense, homeland defense type of a mission. And under the agreements and the protocols that we have negotiated, you could have Coast Guard forces working for a component, or you could have Navy assets working for a Coast Guard entity and trying to intercept a boat offshore, let's say, and do a boarding.
What does the future hold for the U.S. Coast Guard? We will ask Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Thad Allen to share with us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.